You're listening to Rotary Radio UK, where we're joined today by Jamie Baird of Medical Detection Dogs. Jamie, hello.
Hi, Steve.
Right, tell me all about it. Medical detection dogs, what do the dogs detect?
They detect diseases, conditions, cancers, neurological diseases. They also act as support dogs for those with conditions that need attention, so diabetic children maybe who need to be checked during the night. A dog can lie by the bed or lie on the bed in some cases, and if they notice the child's glucose levels are dropping, they will go and alert the parents, and it stops the parents getting up every hour to check. Various conditions where sadly people collapse for no reason in the street or in the supermarket, the dog will provide them with 10 minutes advance warning that something is, that an episode is going to happen. They can find a quiet space to sit or lie down until their episode is over. Same sort of thing with epileptics. They can be given forewarning of fits and so on.
Yeah.
So that's the support side. The detection side is more detecting at an early stage and with accuracy potential conditions.
And those conditions are what?
Cancer. The first condition that we focused on was prostate cancer. We're now also working on colorectal cancer and starting to look at other forms of cancer. Neurological conditions such as Parkinson's, for which at the moment, sadly, there is no advanced diagnosis. People only get diagnosed when they start showing symptoms. And unfortunately, there is no cure. There's only medication to help to control those symptoms. Our dogs, well, first of all, the science tells us that actually people who go on to develop the symptoms will probably have had Parkinson's for 20 or 30 years. And what our dogs are beginning to demonstrate is that they can identify the condition a long way before the symptoms start. And of course, that then allows the medical profession and the science world to come up with cures to prevent these symptoms ever taking place.
Yeah. I think you mentioned earlier that the statistics around people who collapse, say, in the supermarket and having to go to hospital, between the ones without the dogs and the ones with the dogs, the difference is quite enormous.
Those with dogs, one in six, those without dogs, one in six episodes will result in a hospital visit. Those with dogs, it's one in 152 episodes, so a huge difference. And of course, a lot of money is being saved for the NHS simply because people aren't going out. They don't have the confidence. So the episodes are happening in the home and on a carpeted floor, things are probably not quite as dangerous. But the dogs are allowing these people to have the confidence and the ability to go out and lead a normal life like the rest of us, and also saving the NHS a lot of money.
Yeah, sure. Where do the dogs come from?
They come from a number of different sources. All are, first of all, they can be any sort of dog. All dogs have the same nose. We have 5 million sensors in our human noses. Dogs have 300 million in their noses. Now, of course, it's not just the nose, it's also the temperament. And so there are some breeds that you probably wouldn't want to use in this field because they'd be too excitable or maybe potentially dangerous. But any dog with the right temperament can do this. We get donated dogs. My wife and I have donated two puppies to MDD. You can sponsor a dog, which is a bit like owning a racehorse. You don't have to own the whole dog. You don't have to pay for the whole dog. You can pay for a leg or a paw or something, and it'll all contribute to that dog. We buy them, you know, from breeders. Mm-hmm. Clearly, post-COVID, prices have gone rocketing up. Hopefully they'll start to come down again now that those who bought dogs during COVID have looked out they can't look after them as well when they have to go to work. And we get them from rescue centres, which is wonderful because these dogs, which probably have very little, if any, future, are quite capable, if they have the right temperament again, of becoming detection dogs. Yeah. And Claire Guest, our founder, is absolutely passionate about that.
Yes. And I think you mentioned that you get them from the guide dogs for the blind.
Very different skills required for guide dogs. And so what we find is that the guide dog charities will come to us and say, we've got this lovely dog, lovely temperament, but just isn't going to make it as a guide dog. But would it be able to work with you? And very often the answer is absolutely yes. So we do get quite a lot of, I hate to call them, they're rejects, but they're dogs that maybe aren't suited to that particular way of life, but absolutely fine to do what we need them to do.
Yeah, I wrote down recycled guide.
Oh, right, but, that's a much better word, yes.
And how do you train them?
Well, I don't train them. I hasten to point out my wife is a dog trainer, but she wouldn't get involved in this. It is very specialist. What we do is we get samples of a particular condition. Each dog is only trained in one discipline. So you wouldn't have a dog that could detect prostate cancer and colorectal cancer and Parkinson's, because you would then lose what is called the specificity. So in other words, weeding out anything else that might be sensed by the dog, and so it only focuses on the one condition that it's being trained to detect. So what will happen is you'll have a stand with eight pads attached to different arms off the stand. One of those pads will have the condition the dog is being trained to detect. There'll maybe be pads with other conditions that are there, and there'll be, you know, a couple that are simply neutral. And it's up to the dog to go around and just simply distinguish the one that is the one that he or she is being trained to detect.
So people who are listening to this don't need to be concerned that for turning up to the doctor's surgery and having a dog coming up and sniffing around their naughty bits.
not unless they want that to happen. I'm sure it can be arranged, but no. When one contracts a disease or a condition, or something is about to happen in it relating to the condition you already have, our body cells change, and I'm no biologist, but luckily I've been told this in simple terms and I can pass it on. We create what are called volatiles, and those volatiles are then excreted through either our urine or our sweat or our breath. And so we get samples from people with the condition. We get samples from people with no known conditions. And they are then used to create the environment where the dogs are trained to smell those diseases. And in time, what we would expect is that just as we get called by the NHS to provide a sample for our annual bowel cancer check, we'll be asked to provide a urine sample to have our annual prostate cancer check or yes. our annual colorectal cancer check.
And I understand that the dogs have a much higher success rate than the sort of standard things like PSA for prostate cancer.
They do. And part of the reason for this is that the requirement of the medical profession is to try and minimise false negatives. You get some people in the profession who don't think it's worth having a PSA test for prostate cancer because the false positive level is so high. Well, personally, I would rather get a false positive and then breathe a sigh of relief because it turned out that I didn't have prostate cancer than to get a false negative and then 5 years later be on a slab somewhere giving my parts to medical science. Mm. So what the dogs do is, because of the fact that we are telling them to detect only one thing, the specificity is very high. Gleason's is a particularly nasty form, probably the nastiest form of prostate cancer. The PSA test is down at about 50% accuracy. The dogs already, and it's only very recently that Gleason's has come to light, the dogs are already up at well over 70%. And if the trend follows, as with other prostate cancers, they should be up in the 90s fairly soon. And that is both accuracy and specificity. So they detect something, and 94% of the time, it is what they're being asked to detect, not something else.
Yes, I mean, I know from personal experience, I had two PSA tests, and they were sort of, you know, just below the line or just above it. And then I had other tests, and my Gleason score was, you know, at the top of the scale. So that ended up in, well, I'm still here. That was in 2016. But
I'm looking very fit, if I
must say. Well, very kind to say so. But, you know, you had to go through all sorts of things that you might have been able to avoid if the early detection had, had taken place. How is your charity funded?
Almost entirely by donations. We don't take money from the government. We don't ask for money from the government. We got given some money by the government during COVID to see whether the dogs could accurately detect COVID-19, which of course they could. Although we didn't know that at the time, because this was the first time the dogs had been asked to look at a virus as opposed to a bacterial-based condition. Unlike the PPE industry or the vaccination industry, we didn't get any fast tracking, so we had to go through the normal, very lengthy regulatory process. And by the time COVID was under control, we, of course, were still going through that process. But we'd already demonstrated that, unlike those little Chinese lateral flow tests, which were at about 50% accuracy and the specificity was very low because they were picking up flu, colds, anything you might have had in the last 6 months. Our specificity was up at over 93% and our accuracy at over 94%. But of course, it wasn't wasted time and money, because we now know that we can, the dogs can diagnose viruses. And so we'll be able to start work on some of the more unpleasant viruses. And we're all being told that, disease X is on its way. So hopefully we'll be ahead of the game with that.
Yes. Yeah, it is quite extraordinary just how the dogs use their noses. At, as where we tend to use sight and sound, but a dog is driven by what's going on through its nose. And Jamie and I were talking before we started, and I was saying about how if I take my son's retired greyhound for a walk, he'll be happily strolling along a road, and then all of a sudden, bang, in his nose goes into a bush, and something incredibly interesting is going on in that bush, and his nose goes in. But okay, we've talked about dogs, but of course there's somebody now trying to build an artificial nose.
Yes, well, he's been trying for a while now. Dr. Andreas Mershin, who is an American, I think he was originally Austrian or German, but he has a bit of an accent, but he's very much a US citizen. He used to work at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, probably the world's foremost scientific institution, MIT. And working with our dogs, which were flown over. One of the problems, of course, with dogs is that, yes, we can have them in some lab where they can smell samples and so on. But what Andreas, who is a sort of far-sighted gentleman, has in his mind is that we all have an app on our smartphones which will beep at us. Either because we know we have a condition and it's telling us you need to do something about it, or it might be beeping at us to say that, because he will have invented a nose which can detect lots of different things with the same level of specificity as the dogs, it will flash up and say, you need to have your prostate checked, or you need to go and have a test for Parkinson's. Mm. He's not there yet. He's a bit grumpy because, first of all, he's only got this thing down to the size of half a smartphone, and he wants it to be the size of a microchip. But he'll get there. Everything gets smaller. But whilst he's got the... he thinks he's pretty much nailed how the dogs smell, he hasn't quite nailed how the dogs' brains work. Mm. So the analysis of what they're smelling And therefore, what his artificial nose is smelling is still not anywhere near the level it needs to be. Now, we had a talk with him just over a year ago, and he was saying then that he thought it would be 10 years before he perfected this. He's now left MIT and set up a company to develop these bits of kit. And he did that because he felt he'd got to the point, and MIT agreed, where the research side was done. And so he is now saying that it's probably 3 or 4 years before he'll have this app available to put on phones. And, well, I mean, he is a genius. And if it happens, then hopefully he'll be off to get his Nobel Prize.
Yeah, absolutely. OK, we're getting towards the end. So let me ask you perhaps the most important question of all for Rotarians. How can Rotarians support the work that you're doing?
Well, as I said, everything we do is through donations. Now, that can be simple, people putting a couple of quid in a tin in the high street. But more often than not, I do talks. The reason Steve and I got to know each other was I came and gave a talk to his local Rotary Club. And people are very generous at these talks. We also have companies that very kindly adopt us as their charity of the year. And so every time they have an event or any time one of their employees does something like a marathon, they will match fund whatever they raise themselves for the charity. We have sponsorship of dogs, I mentioned before, it all helps, but anyone who thinks that they want to host an event or just raise some money for medical detection dogs, do get in touch with us. We would love to hear from you. Any little helps. It costs £29,000 to train each dog, and the dogs are probably costing now upwards of £1,000 following the COVID boom. And it can cost £500,000 to get a process through the trialing period to where we can actually roll it out formally. So it's a very expensive thing. We're a small charity, and so every penny genuinely does help.
And I've got a feeling you have a website.
We do have a website. It's www.medicaldetectiondogs.org.uk, and on there you can sign up to our online newsletter, which I think comes out once a month and will tell you what we're up to, progress on different programs. It also gives you the chance to donate and sign up for gift aid and so on. And it also provides a lot of information. Our patron is the Queen. She's been our patron since she was the Duchess of Cornwall and very graciously agreed to carry on now that she's got a slightly bigger job. We have been to, I haven't personally, but the charity has been to Clarence House and done demonstrations to celebrate our 15th anniversary earlier this year. She also, during the COVID pandemic, we did a demonstration at Paddington Station to show how the dogs were able to single out those who were carrying COVID and those who weren't, and she was mightily impressed, and did in fact allow a dog to come and sniff her.
No, that's absolutely wonderful. Well, Jamie, thank you very much for coming in today. We're very pleased to announce that Rotary Radio and Medical Detection Dogs will be getting together. They are going to be our charity of the year, so we'll be hopefully hearing more from Jamie and some of his colleagues over the next 12-month period. And I hope you get an awful lot of support from Rotary clubs and individual Rotarians.
Well, that is absolutely fabulous news, Steve. I came here expecting to do a little bit of a radio show, and I've seemed to be going away having won the jackpot. So very, very many thanks to you and all your fellow Rotarians, including my friend in Thailand, if he's still listening, which he probably isn't.
Okay. And your friend in Thailand was... His name?
Steve Wiseman. He's a long-term Rotarian, I'd remembered he was. We used to work together many years ago. I sent him a note saying I was doing this show, and he said the timing is perfect because 11:30 a.m. UK time will be about the time he pours his first beer of the evening. So hopefully he enjoyed the radio show earlier.
That's brilliant. Jamie, thanks very much for coming in.